there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your head. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there.
Welcome to On the Wing podcast, fueled by Purina Pro Plan. About a year ago, I was sitting in a national board of directors meeting for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, minding my P's and Q's, as this employee team is supposed to do, sit and watch and learn. And the gentleman that's the featured guest on today's episode did a presentation to our national board of directors, and it had a massive impact on me. The presentation was about, well, I think the title, correct me if I'm wrong, Dirac, the title was Melting the Green Glacier, or what was the title of the presentation?
That might have been it. Definitely in that line of thinking.
Thought process.
And yeah, of just really the movement to conserve the last segments and areas of grasslands and deal with this green glacier advancing across, you know, the center of the U.S. and really the stronghold of pheasant, hunting opportunities.
And quail.
Absolutely.
So to put that into my words, right, the green glacier, yeah, I like the alliteration. You get a thumbs up from a marketing guy. it's the movement of particularly eastern red cedars and junipers across the northern Great Plains through the middle part of the country, and extending out west. I mean, it's just the massive expansion of woody cover taking over America's grasslands. And one phrase or statistic that jumps out to me you mentioned is that today we're losing more grasslands as a result of woody encroachment as opposed to land conversion from agriculture, which, you know, for many decades this organization's tried to work with our rancher and farmer friends through programs like the Conservation Reserve Program and creating, you know, that mentality of farm the best, conserve the rest. And that's still critically important. But now it's the evolution of our habitat mission where it's still working with farmers and ranchers. But a lot of the land that could be converted to agriculture has already happened. Now what's happening is that woody cover is just expanding across the country in places that used to be grasslands to hold birds. So that's kind of the emphasis of the conversation. I'll let you dive deep into that. Before we start on the nuts and meats and the meat and potatoes of the conversation, I want to learn a little bit more about you. I want our listeners to learn a little bit more about you, because there's a hunting component to your life too, which I think is always interesting for our listeners to hear that personal connection and how they can relate to you. So maybe tell us a little bit. First, the name is Dirac Twidwell. You win the bingo card with the first Dirac I've ever met. So how'd you get your name? Where are you from? Tell us a little bit about your life story.
Yeah, so I was born in North Platte, Nebraska, and so I'm actually Dirac Jr., my dad.
Yeah, and you pronounce it Dirac?
Oh, yeah, but I answer to anything close. You have to. You have to if your name's Dirac. So, yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't help when you spell it.
Yeah.
Because, D-I-R-A-C, nobody can get that right on paper.
Yeah.
But, yeah, my dad had that name, and, you know, you go back, that was during an era of where my grandfather, right, like the 1920s, early 1900s, I mean, that was a prime time for physics and chemistry. And so there's even a couple episodes on Big Bang Theory where you'll hear the name thrown out of Paul Maurice Dirac. You can Google it. He developed quantum physics. So you're talking about like the Einstein level people,
yeah,
of science history. So it kind of keeps me from getting any too big of a head as a professor and scientist. And he's still really well known in terms of what he did. I mean, you know, Nobel Prize winner when you develop a field like quantum physics.
Yeah.
So, and I always thought that was the legacy.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until my wife talked to my mom a few years ago. My uncle actually had passed away. It was my mom's closest sibling in age. And he passed away on high school graduation night in a car accident.
Oh.
And my mom was pregnant with me, and he left a card that said, you know, can't wait to meet Junior. And so that's how I actually got my name. I didn't know that until like 3 to 5 years ago. Mm. And it took my wife for my mom learning. And that's kind of how it is in Nebraska, right? Like you keep those cards pretty close to your chest. But yeah, we moved actually when we were three from North Platte to Curtis, which is interesting given what we'll talk about. And, you know, then we moved to Missouri because my dad worked for the railroad and that was a period of change. So grew up in Missouri. And so went to the University of Missouri Rolla, which is now Missouri Science and Technology.
Huh.
And that was where I first got introduced to, you know, I mean, you go there, it's top five engineering school. You get the opportunity, and I was pre-med, biology and chemistry, but I was able to get in with Missouri Department of Conservation as an undergrad and work on White River Trace, which was a premier quail habitat area, and that's what introduced me to fire. At the same time, you know, my dad coming from Nebraska loved to pheasant hunt. And so we would go from Sedalia, Missouri and go to Kansas every weekend. Like we'd literally leave after I got done with school on Friday and we'd come back before having to go to school on Monday. All the way through when I went to undergrad, it was every weekend. Hmm. And so I know Kansas better than some people that live in Kansas. and, you know, yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of how, you know, many of us got into this field. Mm. I mean, just hunting in the footsteps of our father, and he passed away, what, 3-4 years ago now? So it's you appreciate that, you know, the older you get. And that's why, you know, pheasant hunting, quail hunting, I mean, that's what got me into this entire field. And as a scientist, if I can provide results, information that helps a community, you know, like this and that kind of legacy and history, that's really rewarding. So
yeah, you mentioned you were pre-med math chemistry major, is that
biology and chemistry? Yeah, because
and then you said you started working for the Missouri Department of Conservation.
Yeah, so I did some undergraduate research first with hellbenders and got into it there.
Huh.
And then I just walked into an office looking to get into more terrestrial habitat management. And Rob Chapman at the time was down there, and he gave me a job to start doing some grunt work and just do anything around the place. And then I actually got to start doing management, introduced to fire. That then is really the entryway where we started doing very unique research and experiments on fire in Texas and Oklahoma. So I did my graduate studies at Oklahoma State, PhD at Texas A&M, and we were showing how to better manage grasslands with fire in woody encroachment. And so I've been dealing with these things for a little over 20 years now.
Huh.
But it all started with just that history, you know, quails, you know, it's still one of my favorite birds just from that.
Yeah.
Just the history that you go growing up and get to work on it, and you get the fire bug pretty soon after when you're doing stuff like that.
Wait, when you say pre-med, it makes me think you were heading in to become a doctor. Is that right? Or you didn't quite know and you're, you know, checking a bunch of things on the list and then one thing led to another and wildlife grabbed you?
It's that classic quote where, you know, you're a kid and don't know what you really want to do. And then people are going, oh, you have good grades, go to pre-med. And you're like, but why? I don't even like the sight of blood. This sounds like a ridiculous idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, university, especially when you get involved in outside the classroom, start getting involved in some of the partnerships, see the real world. Like, I couldn't recommend that now more as a professor. Take advantage of the opportunities that maybe are beyond the classroom. It's literally what worked for me and how I move forward. So, yeah, I've completely changed emphasis and approaches and couldn't have appreciated that opportunity more.
Yeah. But,
yeah, pretty common story, I think.
Yeah.
You have no idea. I mean, I'd be lying if I said I did. So,
and here you are.
Yeah.
Tell me about your hunting background and today. Kind of dogs you have, what you normally do on a given, you know, September through December. What do you enjoy?
So, grew up with Britneys and had best hunting dog I ever had was, you know, one that we just followed each other everywhere. And Jake, he was incredibly good Brittany and dog, and just one of those, like, when we would be out there hunting in the field and I could point, you know, hey, we got to go this direction, he might look at me and all I have to do is point, not have to whistle, not, I mean, it was just, we were just like a pair.
Yeah. And Batman and Robin.
We love to do one-on-one hunting. Like, I was big into the letting the dog versus the bird, you know, one-on-one, seeing him try to outthink that. And then me seeing certain terrain or where it's like, all right, he seems off. Let's go over this way. And I'd just point and he'd kind of look and question me and then we'd go over. But otherwise, he'd ignore me at times. And I knew, okay, he thinks there's something faint enough up ahead. It was like that kind of, there's pheasant hunting, but when you have that kind of relationship with the dog, it's just another level. Mm-hmm. And I've always loved that.
And what age time frame was this for you?
So that would have been, we got that dog when I would have been, junior in high school.
Oh, okay. So it was really a good formative time for you to learn.
And we'd been, obviously I'd hunted a lot with quail before then, you know, earlier, but that was then my first, like, truly my dog. And we would go out to areas and just, you know, work one-on-one and then you're kind of training for the real world. And then he would go through with me all the way through master's and PhD. And so, you know, when you're not doing stuff with grad school, we would run up again from Stillwater to Kansas and other places. So we were just always together, you know, guy and his dog. Mm. But then later on had a pointing lab. He passed away a couple years ago. And one of those things where since then looking to convince my wife that I have enough time to do the next round. And my kids are 14, 11, my son 11, so maybe in a couple of years here, he'll be right about that same age and we'll get rolling again. But
well, in a given year, how many licenses do you have in your pocket? Where do you go? What do you, what pulls you in? What kind of birds?
Yeah. So, you know, it was always really enjoyed when I was in Missouri, we'd do a lot with, quail and so forth. Once you get a little less time in your career and everything else, it very strongly became pheasant hunting and longer trips for me. So now it's usually, you know, Nebraska, Missouri, Kansas. Mm. And then when I had the last dog, we'd run up to South Dakota. Mm. And so it was, you know, proximity, but obviously you have really great hunting opportunities across that core network of states.
Right,
so,
right. Kind of the heart of the Great Plains.
Yeah, and I grew up too. I really enjoyed bow hunting and so forth as well. So like a lot of people enjoy going after a lot of different things in Nebraska. You know, mule deer is a really cool opportunity I didn't have. I still go to the Ozarks, Missouri and hunt at my aunt's place, which is just, I just love seeing the different, I don't know, different opportunities, different experiences. So
yeah, right on.
Yeah.
I will transition us to kind of the heart of the conversation. Before I do that, I want to thank Purina Pro Plan is the presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast and a national sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's Wildlife Habitat Mission. All three of my pups, Esky, Gitche, and Winter, all eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports our wildlife habitat conservation mission, which is incredibly important to me, but Purina has the best team of scientists and nutritionists behind their bird dog food. It was made for the hardworking dog. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com. All right, so I introduced this conversation. I've been trying to get you on the podcast for a year. We're finally in the same place, so I'm thrilled to be able to talk with you in person, Durock. Your presentation changed me. I mean, it really informed me. It made me think differently about our habitat mission and how we articulate things. And so, first of all, thank you. And our listeners have probably heard me talk about you and some of the facts you dropped on us over the course of the last year's episodes. You've talked with our editors, our Pheasants Forever editor, the Quail Forever editor. You did a big presentation for our entire marketing team. You you basically have, whether you know it or not, have had an impact on the organization's marketing and communications and how we try to position what we're trying to accomplish from a Habitat perspective. So I want, without the advantage of PowerPoints on a podcast, I want to kind of start from maybe the beginning. When did you get this idea that you wanted to study land use, or not land use, but landscape changes and how woody cover was changing the complexion of America's grasslands? What was the seminal moment for that for you?
Yeah, it's a, so for me, I came in from such a different way of thinking and background, right? And when you grow up hunting and being in Missouri, growing up, you see the fragmentation that was here, some of the issues with invasive species, and then you go west, a state over to Kansas, and it's like, whoa, this is more open and connected in areas. So I think one is I just always, you know, you could connect with horizons and where there was opportunities and how, you know, just, it was just something that kind of came natural. And then when starting to get trained up in rangeland and habitat management and ecology in that section, it's, you kind of learn to look at your feet and look at the kind of plant communities we have here. And and the production that you have, and that's incredibly important. I mean, from what people do with genetics to what's at our feet, but then we were spending a lot less time of looking at the landscape around us. And so that was just something that I just saw as a major opportunity. And when you think of how really landscapes were managed historically, it was definitely a landscape type of process. And so, yeah, so it was just the fact that it seemed like it was something our profession needed to work on more. And that's kind of my personality. So the reason I work on woody encroachment is because it's one of the most impactful and severe consequences that impact human well-being. And people don't know that. Mm. That means that's what society pays professors like me and invests in land grant institutions to do.
So I think we skipped over that. I mean, you were a professor today.
Right.
For University of Nebraska, right?
Yeah.
And you teach on a daily basis?
So, I used to teach. I have a teaching appointment and everything else. A lot of that teaching appointment was bought out so that I could spend more time engaging and, you know, which led to our conversation and so forth, so that we could engage and start better addressing this particular type of problem. I mean, woody encroachment in grasslands, we tend to think of that as one of our impossible problems. Like, how do you actually solve that at scale and meaningful ways? That's like cheat grass out west, or how do you solve the wildfire problem? It's at that class. Mm. And so, doing that sometimes requires, I would tell the joke, I can do three people's jobs, but I can't do five. And so it just allowed us the opportunity to say, if we're going to address this and do a better job of solving it, you know, we need to dedicate time to it. My university did a great job of teaming up with partners where that was a possibility, through externally funded grants and so forth. And what our hope is, obviously, is to connect back, or what we will do, obviously, is connect back. And as we're learning what's working on the ground with actual results, we can actually then double down and teach students that. It's really it's really frustrating to teach students of just how we're losing our, you know, most important and one of our most important land use types, grasslands in America and the Great Plains. And very difficult to do that and not show then how do we have solutions at scale. We can be really good at cutting down trees or burning trees, but that doesn't mean we were sustaining our ecosystems. So I'm excited to circle back, but that's what my current position looks like. And it allows me to engage through and really synthesize more of the science that's coming from multiple areas, like the Green Glacier. The Green Glacier came out of the brain of Dr. Dave Engel at Oklahoma State.
Mm.
And it was a point to try and communicate what the Southern Great Plains of Texas and Oklahoma knew, and say, look, the rest of the central northern Great Plains needs to pay attention. Years later, with modern technology, we were able to actually show what that looked like. And we can actually track. And what you see is just this green tidal wave taking over the central part of the U.S. And what we refer to that as is that's our biome collapsing. everybody learns about biomes. You know, there's the Earth's biosphere, and then there's our biomes, tropical rainforest, grasslands, the taiga, deserts. Our biome's collapsing, and our region knows more about what's happening in tropical rainforest than we do in our own backyard. And boy, if you're into pheasant hunting and quail hunting, this matters, because that's some of our highest density of pheasant populations. Mm-hmm. And nobody knew it because we were so paying so much attention to land use conversion, mm-hmm. which is what did that last century. Mm-hmm. So now you've got a new kid on the block, a new threat that's emerging. And so, yeah, this has been really incredibly valuable, is then we started to show it, and we then turned around and started to look for, you know, hey, who's ready to meet a call to action? Like, we haven't had this kind of scale of change. What I challenge a lot of this generation with now is that no generation of conservation professionals, whether you work for Pheasants Forever, the NRCS, the FSA, Audubon, it doesn't matter which organization, nobody's had to deal with that scale of context of a problem. We're really good at managing local issues and local problems. And so, like musk thistle in eastern Nebraska, you know, people go out and just target it as soon as they see it, trying to prevent it from increasing. But musk thistle doesn't impact our water. And, you know, so that's a big thing. It'll impact our water in areas, impacts our pheasants as it takes over prairies. We see increased disease vectors in cedar woodlands than in our prairies. It's a wildfire, growing wildfire problem, which we don't want in places like Nebraska and South Dakota. There's just such a litany and list of why it's a big issue. Let alone beef production, our economies.
Yeah.
This is true, working lands and habitat. I work on it because, man, these are the threats that we need to solve and address. And I think that's what, I mean, especially looking at now, that's what society wants from universities. And we better be talking with groups like Pheasants Forever and figuring out, wait, how do we better message this? We might have good content, but you all are the pros at messaging it and the outlets and the readership. Those partnerships are incredibly valuable.
So let's. So you just dropped a ton of knowledge.
Yeah, that's, right. That's the problem of having me on
that's
here.
It's wonderful. So let me go back and try to explain some things and clarify. So when you talk about the, you know, looking at these maps and the sure. tidal wave of green, explain what the tidal wave of green. I mean, I have a pretty good idea, and I think our listeners probably understand. But I want you to explain that as. For folks that maybe think they know, but tell them exactly what the tidal wave of green is happened, or what's happened and what's happening.
Yeah, so the Great Plains, you know, goes from southern Canada and Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Alberta, all the way down to the Texas-Mexico border. And when you're talking about biomes, I mean, this is an ancient biome since the last ice age, right? Even with all of the, you know, human intensification, we still see a grassland biome. So we can actually map that and see it. And where one biome stops, another one begins. So you have this ancient grassland biome, which we, you know, right, like just, it doesn't mean there's not other ecosystems in it, but grass dominated fifth of the country. Mm-hmm. And then on the east side, you have this, you know, more temperate deciduous coniferous forest, of course, that eastern Oklahoma, southern right. Missouri. And those biomes, when we looked at them, that boundary is what we were paying attention to. So when you're looking at that eastern Texas, eastern Oklahoma, heading up into Missouri, what we watched was every decade that kept moving. So the biome boundary used to be that area that I just described, mm-hmm. east of the Flint Hills of Kansas, down into Oklahoma and Texas. And what we've watched from the 1990s to 2000s, the Flint Hills are now surrounded. They're part of a more ag, woody-dominated biome. They're no longer part of the grassland biome. Mm-hmm. They're surrounded by something different. Mm-hmm. And it's spread all the way up to where now the leading edge is the sand hills, the eastern central sand hills, all the way to the mid-Missouri River Valley of South Dakota. That's how far it's moved. You know, east of Kansas, Missouri border, down to Oklahoma, now it's moved all the way there. Watching that happen over the course of 30 years and the rate at which that happens is what is concerning to scientists. And that's why that's the green glacier. Think of glaciers as slowly retreating and melting. You kind of paint that imagery.
Right.
We're seeing that, but over the course of 30 years, like these things are supposed to play out over like hundreds or 1,000 years, not this rapidly.
So You know, I think back to the stories of, well, there used to be American bison on the landscape, and they were protecting the integrity of the grasslands because they were just roaming and eating, and it would regenerate. And then at the same time, there were wildfires that were regenerating the grasslands. In the absence of those things, you know, we use rotational grazing and prescribed burning and things like that. Is it the absence of some of those tools, habitat management tools, that's allowing the Green Glacier to take over? Is it the changing climate and precipitation levels in the country? Is it land? Like what? Or is it, yeah, Bob, it's D, all of the above, that is changing and allowing, you know, eastern red cedars and junipers to, you know, take over places that used to be where pheasants lived?
Yeah, so it's always all the above, but we can kind of walk through some examples of knowing just why this is playing out. Mm-hmm. And so the first one was, yeah, we, you know, prescribed fires. I mean, the reason we had fire in the landscape was because indigenous groups, not only here, but everywhere in the world where there was grasslands, indigenous groups burned. And so grasslands, compared to any other type of plant, grasses and forbs thrive compared to shrubs and trees in a burned environment.
Did indigenous folks burn because they knew this intimately, like it was good for...
Oh, of course.
They absolutely knew it, and it was their land management tool.
And it was easy, right? Hmm. Fire was easy. It was something that's done every day. Like, we don't think about that, you know, we have combustion every day we're driving around with our cars. Mm-hmm. We actually practice with fire every day. We've just internalized it. Mm. And it's easy when you drive every day. And so the imagery and documentation just shows, like, yes, it was very easy and it was intentional. It was the management of land, especially those early successional resetting grasslands, like not only for food production, but there's a lot of work too out of, say, like patch burning today is what it's called, or managing heterogeneity. Back then, burning in certain areas and having a certain size of fire, you would get bison congregate on those areas. Like, every ungulate in the world is attracted to recently burned areas. So you get those bison congregating. Well, that sure does make hunting easier. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking back to, like, movies like, you know, Kevin Costner.
Yeah, Dances with Wolves.
Dances with Wolves. And it would show all this trampling and stampede. And I'm like, I bet that was a place that was recently burned if we were to show it correctly with what we know today. Mm-hmm. And that's where they were congregating. Mm. And so one is that we shut that off. Mm-hmm. And back in the day, the profession of, you know, rangeland ecologists would say, well, that's a tool in the toolbox and it's a replaceable tool. Hmm. So we would replace it with, like, Tonka trucks and brush management and chemicals. And what we took for granted was no other process actually could manage seed, the berries of these species and the cones that, you know, get dispersed through landscapes that start the encroachment process.
Only especially fire ones that seed. Release from fire. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, oh, of course. And that was what we knew in forests. In grasslands, seed management is what we think about now because that's how the process starts. They kill seedlings. They can kill mature trees in the right conditions. They can reset an entire stand back to more of a prairie. Only fire can do all of it. So you better bring all your toys, and no other toy consumes seed, which is where it starts. So we shut that off because fire, of course, being the most feared and hated force of nature on the planet, which, so we don't try and eliminate all forces of nature, just fire, taking that for granted. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing are the consequences of removing it at a global level. Number two, I mean, you're talking eastern red cedar. The reason it's a poster child, it might be the most fire-sensitive plant in the Great Plains. So it had to hide into rocky outcrops, you know, in some of the riparian areas where fires wouldn't really get to a really low intensity. Doesn't resprout after fire. It's real easy to manage with fire in the right conditions. But it also then was identified as the ideal thing for us to plant, breed, distribute. So we took it from where it was rare, went through generations of breeding programs and distributed them all over our intact grasslands, which means if you just shut out fire, it would have had to have spread. And we watch that, right? That's what's driving the Green Glacier. You can see it spreading. And it would have taken a lot longer time than these 30 years if we hadn't then introduced seed sources to where it was never at. Mm. It was over there a county away or rare over here. That means that people are ambushed everywhere. If you're a rancher or conservation professional, you're fighting the fight on all sides. Mm-hmm. If it was just fire that was shut off, right? All these other tools, maybe we'd have more of a chance.
Sure.
Oh, we also made you manage more land area because they got distributed. And of course, what I'm talking about are windbreaks and shelter belts.
Yep.
And it's like, well, wait, what about the winter? We love finding them in the winter of North Dakota or South Dakota. And it's like, sure, but when things are rare, they tend to have value, like a blowout in the sand hills and blowout penstemon. That's endangered species. But we don't want a dust bowl. It totally changed the game. So a windbreak that can be managed versus one that then contributes to spread and risks an entire livelihood in a ranch, we want things to stay rare. We want to be able to manage those things. And we didn't know that when we were starting that campaign 100 years ago, but we do now.
Mm.
So those are the two things that, no matter what, climate change, you know, the CO2 increases, nitrogen, everything else that is changing and contributing to woody encroachment, it's the those two things, even if you didn't add the other, still would have caused encroachment everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take everything off the table, this was going to happen.
Just
and that's why it's happening
slower.
Everywhere. It would have been just slower. So everything we do is speeding up the rate. That's why we work so much to say, how do we slow all that down to give us a better fighting chance and at larger scales?
So I think about the grassland loss, and it's very visual through with the woody encroachment. What's not as visual is the impact on water.
Right.
Right, because eastern red cedars suck just a ton of water from the aquifer. Particularly, I think about the water issues in the Great Plains, the Ogallala Aquifer. I don't know if you can drop a statistic on me on what the impact of this green glacier moving forward means to water and water quantity.
So it's really an important discussion, and what I'll do is walk through multiple. So there's some things that, as scientists, we know as absolute facts associated with, like, cedar woody encroachment. In every state, as this plays out and you go from grassland to a cedar-dominated woodland, ranchers lose 75% livestock production on those sites long-term, everywhere. So that's something that always happens. Like, livestock production always declines. Grassland-dependent species always decline.
Hmm.
There's some things that are more of the very few absolutes, and scientists don't like to talk in these absolutes very often. Wildfire danger does go up because it's a volatile fuel expanding. So there's the wildfire issues, one that we have high certainty in of why we don't want this. And then you get into more complicated things, and water is one of the biggest ones debated in the science because it's so complex from one ecoregion to the next. It's very different of what happens with juniper on the Edwards Plateau than maybe the sand hills of Nebraska or the Smoky Hills of Kansas. So water is just debated so much because it's in those regions and how it functions. So there's some areas where it's been highly shown, some good work out of Oklahoma State with Chris Zhao, some good work out of Kansas State. There was one study we did in Nebraska where you see reductions in stream flow, impacts with, like, just water tables, but there's a lot of other research that shows the exact opposite in
really?
Some locations.
Huh.
So you just, and then what's it take to, you know, manage that water cycle or some of the hydrology and that complexity? It's challenging. So there's a lot we don't know in that space. That's very different than, like, say, wildfire, or what we know with, like, biodiversity conservation. So we're always, and sometimes that gets in the way of our message as scientists. We're trying to debate and learn more so we can give honest feedback to, you know, the public, to the legislature, to you all. And our debates sometimes enter in where people are like, well, dang it, would you just tell us
yeah.
what the issues are?
Right. We want black and white answers.
Yep.
We don't want gray. So
and
what you're saying is a little bit, there is some gray area
on
the impact of water quality on this green glacier.
And that's what makes it hard of then making decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also why we generally think, hey, at large areas or large scales, a monoculture of where cedar starts to dominate, whether that's the understory of the oaks, you know, mm-hmm. in Missouri and their woodlands or across our prairies of Nebraska and Kansas, those tend to lead to such severe consequences relative to some other benefits or trade-offs, because it's always both, that seems like that's not a smart idea for society at large. I mean, we've even connected it to losses in school funding in places like Nebraska, because there's 1 million acres of grazing lease land. That's revenue that all gets generated to go to schools like Omaha, Lincoln, Kearney, things that people don't know of what grasslands provide. Hmm. That's why you care about this issue. It's one of the only issues that affects every citizen in our states. Wow. And that's what happens when you lose a biome and we take it for granted. Having specific conversations about water, we want to invest more in that kind of science and information to figure out like how exactly and what's it going to take to make sure and manage some of these water resources, while not overgeneralizing and overblowing it to where then we lose trust when that doesn't work in some locations for water, because it won't do that everywhere. So yeah.
It's complicated.
It always is.
Yeah.
If it wasn't, this would be already have been solved and I'd be working on something else.
Well, you did. One of the things you said was a lot cleaner is the impact on the ranching economy. So explain that a little bit more. I mean, it's somewhat intuitive. You lose grass through encroachment, woody cover, you lose forage. I mean, is it as simple as that?
Yeah, what they do as a rite of passage. So when I first started my master's degree, we went down to Texas at the Sonora Experiment Station. It's on the Edwards Plateau. And the first thing you do is you do studies where they have you look at how much is growing underneath, you know, juniper trees, and you crawl through there and you find out it's nothing. So everybody sees that image long term where it's like, wow, there's no grass here. It's really hard to imagine it used to be something else. So we all go through a rite of passage of what grows underneath cedar trees, and the answer is nothing. And now you can get a degree, and it's kind of a running joke. But when you're a rancher in this and you think of it long term, the way I describe it is that it's such a slow process. So, you know, when you go from an intact prairie that's treeless and then the first couple cedar trees come along, you don't feel that production loss, right? Like it has to get enough other trees around it where you really start to see a lack of biomass, and it takes time. So basically the way I might tell a story around it is you go from your kid being born and then they learn to drive and go off to the University of Nebraska. You're like, oh, look at my child growing up, right? And that's the time frame you're thinking of. And trees are coming into my area. Cedar trees are. And isn't that nice? They look kind of pretty. Mm. Makes me think of the front lines of Colorado. And, you know, some shade for my cows and other stuff. And then they go to the University of Nebraska, leave your house, and you have a midlife crisis. Because the next 20 years, you lose 75% of your livestock production. Mm. And so that's such a mind job, right? When you're going from my kids are born over a 20-year period going off to college, you're not feeling the impacts, especially because there's other things playing out like drought. So it's hiding, if you're a producer, it's hiding the impacts that are coming because you're feeling something else like precipitation year to year being different. And then the next 20 years, that production just crashes because those trees are just taken over.
Huh.
And that's when everybody hits the crisis point. Of course, when you wait that long, the costs of getting back what you lost through management are now hundreds to thousands of dollars, whereas if we had kept intact in the first place, it's pennies to dollars on the acre. So it's a double whammy. Getting back what you lost in restoration is hugely expensive, and losing 75% of your income is a huge problem.
Right.
And you think about that as a level of producer, you're like, man, that, of course, is affecting their livelihood, bottom lines. When you step back and think about it from the ag industry, and grasslands aren't talked about a lot in how we contribute to our agricultural economies. When you look at the losses from 1990 to going all the way to 2020, 2022, whatever our most recent stat was, some nice work with Scott Morford out of the University of Montana. He had actually summed up the numbers, and you're talking like $175 million in lost production for the entire Great Plains. We would have liked to have had that in years like this year where it was dry across so much of the plains. So it hits a huge bottom line, and we need to better connect how grassland loss actually starts to affect our number one economy in a lot of states, the beef supply chain, and not taking that source for granted just because we've always been there. When there's a drought in grasslands, we still grow the majority of our grass. That's not, right? Like, you don't have failed grass yields in any year. It's hard to get less than 50% production in our prairies. So we're pretty stable compared to any other agricultural, you know, type of land use.
Hmm.
So that's something that then you might take for granted because mm-hmm. we're always there. We can't take it for granted. That's coming. And then you have things like the hunting industry,
mm-hmm.
right? And you don't think about, like, maybe, wait a minute, our pheasants are tied to larger areas of grassland. You know, we kind of hunt pockets
right.
within a sure. bigger prairie system. And as those get fragmented, you lose it. All of a sudden, you're like, wow, they sure are declining faster now. Same thing for a rancher. You're not seeing the slow erosion that then crosses a threshold or tipping point and speeds up losses. So pheasants, cattle, you know, when you hear bird conservationists worried about woody encroachment,
mm-hmm.
we used to say cattle will be next. And pheasants were kind of somewhere between a prairie chicken and a cow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we started to get the conversation going before our maps was just, you know, when I first got to Nebraska, the bird world was concerned because it was starting to hit. They were feeling it. And that's how I communicated to our grazers was like, listen over there and look what's coming. So now with the kind of maps or imagery we have, if people go through that in their areas and don't think they have a problem, and we can actually start to show this and they get past the denial,
yep.
which has always been our hardest part. How do we get people to prevent habitat loss, which is how this organization was formed?
Right.
That type of challenge has really been difficult. And that goes all the way back to why Dave Engel created that Green Glacier deal. We're trying to create an imagery where people acted earlier.
Yeah.
We're now seeing that. There's burn associations is one of the ways that a lot of landowners came together to try and deal with the woody encroachment problem. We wrote this paper over 10 years ago in 2013 that showed burn associations follow the Green Glacier.
Hmm.
Today, we have burn associations started in North Dakota and recently in Saskatchewan when I was a trip there. You have places in eastern Wyoming, central Nebraska, ahead of the line, you know, west central Kansas, the very western panhandle of Oklahoma. You're seeing more groups get really aggressive banding together because of lessons learned of other regions. That's incredibly difficult to inspire and do. And we're just a small cog of taking a lot of information and sharing it. And it's a credit to the entire workforce, ranching communities as well, industry of saying it's time that we scaled up what we're doing and tried to do something different.
So I think about, I keep coming back to this visual from your PowerPoint of, I think it, you know, you migrated it from Kansas to Nebraska to South Dakota. And the visual in my mind are these ravines, these canyons where drainage is, right? Where water flows down to whatever, a river, a stream, a pond. And how the brush, the eastern red cedars, the juniper sort of start to populate those fingular, the canyons going down. And I think about that as a hunter. You know, those little, you know, ravines that you walk down that you think you're going to find the huns, right? In the little mm-hmm. ravines on the low spots, you know, flats. Oh, there might be sharp tails in here. When you get up to the top of it, you know, pheasants and quail right at the top, you know. So, but over time, you go back to some of these places and there's more and more cedars choking out the ravine, you know, every other year. And then, you know, 10 years down the road, it's completely choked out with cedars and you can't hardly get through, right? I mean, it is a biological desert because there's nothing underneath it other than rock and dirt. And then it spreads to the tops of those ravines and just starts pushing out where the pheasants and the quail lived. And all of a sudden, you know, the ravines are not only not good, the tops are not good. And that you see that, I mean, from a hunter's eyes, that's kind of what you're talking about, isn't it? So I'm thinking about you growing up as a hunter to your lens as a biologist. How much did your hunting eyes inform your scientific eyes in being able to see what was happening on the landscape and knowing that this was coming and, you know, inspiring where you are today and trying to create this movement?
You know, that's a That's a, yeah, that'll be a nice personal, emotional question, because that goes back to what we did with, I remember my dad and I going and actually talking about, I mean, here I am starting graduate school after high school, undergrad, then, so now it's like, I've been hunting for over a decade. And in graduate school, I remember us talking about, you know, looking at the quality, and a lot of people, you know, might mention that with certain walk-in areas, you're going, oh, they, you know, this isn't the quality that it was 5 years ago, or we lose some of our best areas to cultivation, or, you know, just the grazing pressure in a year and the lack of nesting cover. But we were always standing back as well, just looking at some of the broader, like, squeezing in of some of our favorite places to hunt and where we would go. And it wasn't until a lot later. And so one was, it was always one of those dreams where maybe you can contribute something in your profession to what I always say, I do things for 8-year-old me. Mm. And it goes back to being out there, you know, hunting with your dad and brother and just being able to go, like, maybe I'll have something that would be useful. And that's kind of, you know, what all of us want to do.
Right.
And that's a way to contribute collectively to what all of us care about, you know, as 8-year-olds, and things like pheasant hunting is one of them. And so yeah, you know, and so we were seeing that, but then it wasn't until some of those maps and images that you're talking about in the PowerPoint where I was going, oh my gosh, if I follow from 1990, which I would have been 10, but if I follow from then about 1994 forward to today with the data, you could actually see we're in the state of Kansas as hunters. My dad and I moved west.
Huh.
And
because you were finding more birds west because there was more grass west.
You would just, there was, the years were more variable on some of the leading edge. And we were, you know, right? Like, I mean, we're happy to say it, we're good pheasant hunters. So when your opportunities are more variable year to year because of this expansion and kind of slow erosion, and we weren't thinking about that. We were just, we would try places that we'd had success in the past, and it was just less consistent in places that were highly consistent the decade before and should still be, but it was the landscape kind of around it, just squeezing some of that population. And yeah, so over the course of 20 to 25 years, like, we moved west as hunters where there was just more habitat. And we didn't think of this major woody encroachment as part of habitat loss. It's not classified under land use change. Mm-hmm. It's just not something we capture and think about. But boy, we were responding that way, and I didn't even know it. Now we talk about it too with what you said. Like, we can zoom into areas and show ranchers or conservation partners what we see in their areas. And I remember in Northeast Nebraska going, I know where your chickens are just from this. And they kind of chuckled and looked later and where their inventory was. Like, dang it, he's right. You can see the pockets that are more intact. So in those landscapes, even locally, I guarantee over the course of 30 years, locally and so forth, hunters and their opportunities have squeezed compared to where they would have been 20 to 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's just what we're seeing everywhere. So yeah, what's nice about hunting and what's nice about just being out there and experiencing habitat, like, it, one, gets me out of any ivory tower that you might think exists for a scientist, but it's just part of who you are. And so when you're out there, you're not thinking about, like, what your normal job is or anything else. Mm-hmm. And it just influences some of your thinking and just, you know, ways to try and approach problems that maybe go outside traditional training and how we teach students. So yeah, making it part of your lifestyle allows you to just see a much bigger picture. And you don't know when some of your data actually is walking into, you know, man, this is affecting my lifestyle.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
the message on woody encroachment. And I think that hunters are going to continue to see it. We need to be able to tell the people in Kansas City, Omaha, Denver, any of our cities, New York, it shouldn't matter. This is affecting our way of life in even urban areas.
Right.
We're just feeling it first because of what we care about is directly tied to it. But things like wildfire, school funding, in some places, right? Mm-hmm. The water discussion, that affects all of us.
Or price of a ribeye.
Oh, don't you know it? Mm-hmm. And yeah, that where do you get cheap, affordable cattle from? Mm-hmm. Rangelands. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's the continued story that maybe we haven't told. And I think to your question, really nicely connects back to why when we have data and partnerships and can tell stories around lifestyle, that's so much more powerful.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we don't always know when that is. Like, I didn't know that our data was doing that. Huh. But
you mentioned earlier, you know, that people in Curtis, Nebraska, know more about the loss of rainforests or coral reefs than they know about the loss of grassland as a biome in their own backyard. Why do you think that is?
Well, not in Curtis, but in the United States of America, that's true. Mm. Everywhere. In Nebraska, it's true. We teach on the loss of tropical rainforests. I mean, Nebraska, for example, has a biome week. We're not talking about grasslands. We're talking about things like tropical rainforests. So one is like there's an education point, and that's on us, and we need to fix that, and we need to fix it soon. But Curtis specifically is interesting. I guarantee you in that area, that's not true. The kids in that small town, they know about what's happened in grasslands. We've heard stories about students actually taking some of our products and images and maps and finding a data point, like a stat of how much production's been lost in Lincoln County, Nebraska, where Curtis is at, and they'll show that to a teacher in a classroom of why their family burns in the Les Canyons of Nebraska.
Okay, so this is a good – so you feel like the folks in McCook and Kearney,
yep.
They recognize that it's happening on the landscape in their own areas, or is Curtis an anomaly?
It's kind of where things start, right? Like you see what happened in Curtis – and it makes it really ironic living this life of mine. So born in North Platte, I was 3 years old living in a very small town of Curtis that has a couple hundred people in it. And then we move out of state and I grow up in Missouri. And we come back to Nebraska as a professor 30 years later. And obviously we were doing a lot of work in science with burn associations. And to answer certain questions at scales, you have to do that with private landowners because we just don't have the land area, public land, university sites. Some questions you have to work with landowners. And they were one of the ones I got introduced to. What I did was I was an invited guest. We were at a steakhouse. There's about 20 ranchers and a couple conservation professionals, one Andy Moore from Pheasants Forever, and so forth. And I'm sitting in that room and realize, right, like that's an uncomfortable room as a guest. That's like asking one of them to sit with 20 professors. You're going to feel a little awkward when you're doing it for the first time. So I'm just sitting there and I'm trying to figure out a way to have an icebreaker because they're all saying hi and getting to know each other. And finally the waitress is coming out and is like, "Hey, so what's good here?" And they're like, "Chicken fried steak, of course." And they all looked at me and they said, "But you can't handle the large, you need the small." And I'm like, "Oh, come on." You know, sure enough, I ordered the small, and then, you know, the next three people ordered larges, but the larges came out on two full-size plates spread over it. So they were right. I could only handle the small.
It was like John Candy in the movie, you get a t-shirt if you eat it.
There's no way I was going to get that t-shirt. What was so impressive about that afterwards is when you're a guest in their setting, it gave me the opportunity to learn what they were thinking to deal with. They wanted to know what was happening everywhere else. We have these islands of communities of ranchers that are coming together to try and maintain their way of life and restoring fire across a biome. That's what the burn association model's been doing. This group asked me an hour and a half of questions before I then got to ask them an hour and a half of questions.
Hmm.
And what led to that was I'm just part of the team, used to be from Curtis, right there. We're meeting in a steakhouse in Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
And this is now known to be one of the most successful burn associations anywhere in the world. They went from, in 2002, a couple ranchers meeting around this common problem and issue that was taken over their region, to now having, in a 350,000-acre ecoregion, 300,000 acres of it are tied to landowners. They've restored an entire culture in a period of what was 15 years. And you don't see many places in the world that have restored fire as a community. That means every neighbor is part of a burn association outside of a few. That's incredibly powerful for restoration and conservation in their system. And we've just shown so many then benefits. Birds are increasing in the less canyons, grassland birds are. That's the outcomes we want to see, not just on a place where we did a treatment. We're talking at a regional scale, birds are increasing.
Oh, wow.
They're seeing increases in quail in that landscape. We've seen increase in American burying beetle, which was federally threatened when this started. The population is actually stable, slightly increasing. Grassland plant richness is increasing. It's such a cool, heterogeneous landscape. Wildfire danger has been reduced. That's something that we showed in the last couple of years. What a great story.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the stories that we can build on. And that goes back to, it's hard to talk about only a biome that's losing. If we can tie that kind of imagery to then the partnerships at scale that are leading to the results we want in the public, that's what we want to build around.
Mm.
And that led to where we started sharing the story. So when that's when we started to see a change where nobody knew. There's still a lot of education awareness that we need to get into the system, but there's less denial of this will never happen here. We're past that, all the way up into North Dakota, Eastern Wyoming. Like, it can happen here. It will. And even look at the information, we're even starting to see it. But it took us also to know that we need to have more examples of building this out. So I went to, when you saw that graphic that you often talk about, I went and talked to Shelley Kelly with the Sandhills Task Force. And the Sandhills, for a lot of listeners here don't know, Sandhills is the most intact temperate grassland region remaining on the planet.
Underscore that. That's unbelievable, right?
When I got to Nebraska, I mean, we knew it was a special place.
Right, right.
The Flint Hills is the last remaining tallgrass prairie ecoregion in North America. There's a reason these places are special. Wow. It wouldn't be there without landowners using prescribed fire.
Mm-hmm.
The Sandhills, number one. Well, of course, this green glacier moving through is now at the front edge and on the doorstep of the Sandhills, which, by the way, that eastern side has one of the largest remaining populations of greater prairie chickens, which is the only one not to make its way on the endangered species list, right? So I show her the information. I'm like, look, we need to do something special. I'm in a dark place. Like, our 8-year-old me, we don't want to just have small pockets of grassland left. We have to figure out how to scale it out. Back at the turn of the century, you're talking like 1890s to 1910s, Charles Bessie established the biggest hand-planted forest in the world in the middle of the Sandhills. Remarkable deal. Somehow they got cedar to establish, which was impossible, is what they thought back then. I told her, I want to do that. Because I want to show people how easy it would have been to manage woody encroachment if we started before there was woody encroachment and we kept these places intact. And I showed her then the data of why. Because only the Flint Hills with all their fire made it flinch. Only the Les Canyons had halted that regional expansion. So I have two places in the biome when we first started looking. This was about 5-6 years ago. She goes, how many acres are you talking about? And I go, 1 million acres. I want 1 million acres in the center of the Sandhills, right? Like, voluntary with landowners, like, let's just work together like it's the 1890s and let's show that it could have been easier. There's got to be 1 million acres in the last largest intact temperate grassland on the planet where landowners want to keep this out. She goes, man, it's still 1 million acres a lot. And so, like the used car salesman that I am, I said 100,000 acres. Like, so that was the plan. Uh-huh. The plan was to drop my price and remove a zero. And it's like, oh, well, we could do that.
Yeah.
And then we started sharing that story, went to the Gip Hills of Kansas and had a meeting that started at like 8:30 at night, showed some of these things zooming in, like you were talking about, where they could then see theirs in it. And they're pointing on the screen. People just sitting there with Dixie cups in a shop, you know, 12 ranchers that really are involved. And they sat there and some stayed till 1:30 in the morning.
Wow.
And that's the key, right? Like, I'm a guest. I'll stay there until the sun comes up if that's what they want to do. And this just started to take off like wildfire. So in the Sandhills, and we're looking to now show the story starting this year of now look, here's the Green Glacier and what we're losing, mm-hmm. and now look at what groups of ranchers and conservation help support and professionals are doing together at unprecedented scales across multiple states.
To prevent it.
And yeah, to prevent. And then can we even get back on offense and grow what some of what we've lost? We now know in the Sandhills, for example, now after 4 or 5 years, remember, dark place.
Yeah.
There's not much evidence globally that we can stop, you know, the loss and collapse of ecosystems at these scales. And dealing with woody encroachment, there's not a lot of evidence of in the literature of halting that in temperate grasslands anywhere. We know we have millions of acres now in the Sandhills across a couple different complexes where voluntary conservation is scaling up as the plan. So you go from thinking about how to manage at our feet and how to manage in pastures to saying, well, that's going to work, though, within a large planning horizon on 100% private land areas.
Hmm.
And then we started to see groups like Game and Parks go, well, maybe we ought to be tying like demonstration areas tied to some of our state lands because people in the public can't see those. Valentine National Wildlife Refuge, a Fish and Wildlife Service site, then they kept some of their more valuable woody species of cottonwood and some shrubs, but cedar's gone. And so is the area of private lands around it. So they're on board. Halsey National Forest actually now has this core area where they protect themselves from that old hand-planted cedar mm-hmm. forest and have this whole grassland area that connects within the private lands around it. So you're seeing an entire scaling up of public lands. And the National Park Service, for example, then wanted to do the same thing with the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve in Chase County, which has the most tallgrass prairie remaining in the U.S., but also across their network of sites. And why? Because that's where the public sees.
Hmm.
But we need those places to communicate what we're doing on private lands and get this story out of how important this is and look what we're building relative to what the pressure is that we feel in that Green Glacier.
So is this the defend the grow the core, grow the core concept that so, people maybe have heard of?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that came from a landowner.
Hmm.
You know, we're not very good at branding on our side. That's why you have a marketing team. You didn't hire a bunch of scientists for it. So when we have this, a landowner had brought that up. And from some of the early discussions I was having with Shelley in the Sandhills, that was something that then they did an Idaho cheatgrass challenge on.
Hmm.
And very similarly, where do we spend all our money on cheatgrass? Where you have a bunch of cheatgrass, horrible wildfire problems, and rightfully so. But Jeremy Estes did a nice job out there of showing, look at how this is expanding into areas that are more intact. And are we spending money there? Well, of course not, because we're so focused over here where it's a bigger quote-unquote problem.
Right.
But we're going to lose areas. And that was their priority, sage-grouse habitats. So, okay, how do we flip that around? And that was then that group for the Idaho Cheatgrass Challenge came up with a defend the core, grow the core,
right.
and something like mitigate the impacts, like the point being be more realistic in areas. So for us, where we have cedar around a bunch of houses, we're not getting that back for habitat and grassland and beef and so forth. So what is it that I don't want to see? I don't want to see those houses burning down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why groups like Nebraska Forest Service or Kansas Forest Service do things like FireWise. Great. That's part of this. We also don't want to lose our sandhills from that stuff spreading. That's where another group is part of it. And so I think all of that, even something like FireWise, is kind of a defend the core idea. You're just protecting houses. Like it applies. It's just trying to prevent further loss of these last remaining important habitats.
Gotcha.
And so, but it's kind of just a brand, right?
Yeah. And you talked a lot about fire as kind of the primary tool to, you know, pushing back the Green Glacier. Are there other tools, or is it really fire's the straight ticket, homie?
So, you know, I mean, go back what we said before. The use of fire by indigenous groups for thousands of years, like that's where fire or that's where grasslands as a large biome and system thrived. So one is that there's proof that that worked.
Yeah.
Two is that where we see a lot of these today, when you have where you have a lot of intact grasslands, like in the northern half of the Great Plains still, they haven't felt the pressure of what's coming. So it's like, well, we don't need fire. Our system looks great. we haven't felt this yet. Mm. And it's coming and it's starting, and that's the point. Everywhere you see a lot of your larger grasslands that you go south all have fire cultures. So is it possible that we could replace fire as a tool? Well, what do we have to do? We have to prevent seed from moving into our intact grasslands. And so there's some ranchers that are like, all right, I'm going to, they talk about seed source management now. It's a new thing last couple of years of how they, instead of talking about brush management, they talk about seed source management. And it's for this reason. Mm. And they might go out with loppers or haying. But the point is that you better keep that from becoming a 6 foot tall tree when it starts to produce berries. Because what happens is that that tree produces a berry. 95% of recruitment is within 2 football fields of that seed source.
Hmm.
So if you then lose 2 football fields, you're now having to manage more acres. You've let it produce another one, you lost 2 more football fields. So that's why they chase it across their entire ranch or areas. So yeah, like loppers, haying. I make the joke that the Nebraska football team, it would benefit if we just hired them all to start pulling cedar trees out of the ground. Like, we got to change something up there. So yeah, it doesn't much matter what we do. And ranchers then come up with tons of different ways to torture, you know, mm-hmm. and get after, you know, woody encroachment coming through prairies. But it's unproven so far. Like, and but that's where you start. So part of the message with like areas of South Dakota and so forth, and where you lack fire cultures, areas like Western Sandhills, was just get started managing it. And there's always somebody that eventually might turn to prescribed fire, and they're able to just look at their neighbor across the fence and see what's going on. And there's some people that'll never be comfortable with prescribed fire, and that's fine. Manage your area to where it's also not contributing to spread on your neighbors mm. in your area. Like, it's going to be more higher maintenance, but I just don't feel comfortable with fire. The point is, you've got to keep it in basically a trap. You're trying to trap woody plants to not reproduce. We always waited till they reproduced and then just cut them down or burned them and wondered why that wasn't working long term.
Gotcha.
So it's possible. It sure is a lot easier when you don't have much seed source to deal with. It's a lot less possible when you have ambushes on all sides, because fire just can manage so effectively. I mean, think of how many acres you can do with a burn compared to how long it would take you to do that by hand. And we'll do future trainings where we give everybody a lopper and say, go lop this off when you're recommending to the landowner that's what to do.
Hmm.
It is work. And in some areas, depending on the number of seedlings coming in, you look up and you feel like you didn't get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's possible in theory.
Sure sounds like fire's the better answer.
Well, in areas where you've got the culture and can grow it, we've seen a lot of success. And so yeah. That's been proven all the way back to indigenous groups and today with collections of ranchers. But at the same time, when people are willing to put in the work and do other things, like, great, we're at least getting more people on board where it's like, this isn't your only option. And just try managing it when it's early. If they don't, we know they turn to fire, they lose that, you know, working lands, grassland resource. So
let's take it as we get close to the finish line here. What's the next, the intersection with what you're doing, what you've learned, your work for the university, and Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever? How are we partnering with you to help solve this?
So it goes back a little bit where when I was in grad school, I mean, I've gotten to do I feel really fortunate with what I've got to do in this life a bit when I think back on it. When I got to grad school, we designed experiments to light fires in conditions that were usually in burn bans, and we called them the extreme fire tiles or prescribed extreme fire. And those were on plots of areas, right? Kind of classical scientific plots, you know, maybe like 10 by 30 yards or 20 by 30 yard plots. And we set it up and it was easily controlled. Still never forget one of the stories in Texas where they were like, called it in, hey, we're doing this fire experiment. We have government exemption. And they're like, we have 6 wildfires occurring within 30 miles of you. And this was like back in 2011. And I said, yep, we have exemptions. We'll call you when we're done. That doing things like that's like catching lightning in a bottle as a scientist, right? We're controlling fire in conditions people thought were largely impossible.
Hmm.
And it was very easy when you have the right setup, know what you're doing. You start there and you're like, okay, where do we go next when you've done that kind of experiment? well, you go from 20 by 30 yard plots to working with landowners at scale. And that's what took me to things like these larger burn association groups. And then you start to learn all this stuff that you don't get if you're not engaged with these partnerships. And so a lot of these areas, you know, us being engaged in, you start being able to be part of the team of what we bring with science and content to what like landowners are trying to accomplish and Pheasants Forever and other agencies in that area are trying to support. All of a sudden, you've got a highly functioning team. When we're talking about, is there some areas for our grasslands that can withstand this green glacier moving through to where we have habitat and working land opportunities for future generations? And by the way, like saving the rainforest for grasslands is what we're talking about here. That's what I'm going to spend my time on. The only way I can run an experiment like that is with organizations like this, because I can't do that on university or, you know, lands. We don't have the size and we're not responsive enough to be able to move at the speed that ranchers do. And so from my end, like, you're a field biologist with Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. That's, you would think of those like, that's my experimental team. They're doing the treatments. The study sites are the network of landowners with a common vision of keeping grasslands intact. I'm just bringing then the team of like the data analysts and the content, and we're circling that back to where it's not like extension doesn't just happen through us. Extension happens through the landowner voices. They pull these talking points out of their back pocket, or that kid in Curtis that showed it to his teacher, or your all's marketing team. We just finally figured out again where we were supposed to play a critical role, and it's being engaged in these groups. So then you get really addicted to understanding where our job has the most impact, which is why I became a professor. I was going to be a manager like every other PF person, but I knew that I might have the potential to impact this, you know, lifestyle I love and system more as a professor. So if we can do that there, and you're seeing these start up across multiple areas of the Great Plains, and nobody even knows these origin stories anymore. It's just scaled up. People are using information. They don't know it came from us or somebody else to plan and implement. We're going to make sure that we have everybody's backs and show the results of this five-year explosion, right? Like, I wanted a spot in the sand hills of 100,000 acres used car salesman. We have those across all these states now that are growing. Let's start showing the results of that. And let's start letting them tell their story. Like, look what's happened in the Arbuckles of Oklahoma. Look what's happening over here in the Gypsum Hills of Kansas, the Sand Hills, Lower Brule, South Dakota, Eastern Wyoming. Like, that's going to be the future. And those are the stories people want to read about. They don't want to hear the ecologists just talk about the sky is falling, even though we're pretty good at that. So the next 5 years.
It is like... You're talking about it through the lens of an academia as an experiment, right?
Yes.
And the Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever biologists are like, we're out there creating habitat, and we're the intersection to landowners who are looking at it from a bottom line, right? Like, if we can push back the woody encroachment, our ability to, you know, have forage for cattle is going to pay the mortgage and put, you know, Billy and Susie through college. So it's just a matter of the lens of the audience, right?
That's exactly right. I did that on purpose. Most of the people, we don't think of things like this as an experiment. In my brain, it's an experiment.
Because an experiment feels so institutional and, right, like it's not actually, but it's dirty, it's messy, it's real world, right?
And that's the difference, right? This isn't a greenhouse. Like, certain questions I need to go do over there or in a highly controlled environment. But what does that not give me? It doesn't give me the complexity and the size and extent and all these other issues of the real world. So I need these messy things over here because the controlled experiments don't do everything I need.
Right.
And the only way I can do those is with the people that plan and build it. And I mean, there's no other option for us. So that's what's been so rewarding is like, yeah, these other ways of doing experiments and models and science are very valuable. But where all of the things happen with actual land management decision-making is tied to the people that control the land, which are those landowners. And that's the Pheasant Forever model. It's this grassroots, bottom-up, we can help with planning, right, to connect multiple people and landowners, structure that. Perfect. That allows us to plug in the same way and be this bottom-up, grassroots, land-grant institution model. That's where we're at our best. We're all just bringing our skill sets and niche, and it's hugely valuable because then I'm not trying to do everything. You know, Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever is not trying to do everything. Every organization kind of knows how they fit, and we basically have a highly supportive workforce mm-hmm. for these people that are making a living on their lands for their families, and we're asking them to do even more for, you know, all these ecosystem services, upland hunting opportunities, and everything else. Man, we better be good at our jobs as a team because right. they don't get paid for all that right. stuff.
For folks that are members, chapter volunteers, you know, they're listening to this and thinking, yeah, I've seen change on the landscape around me. What do you want them to do? Do you want them to contact their farm bill biologist? Do you want them to, you know, get in touch with their burn association, see if there's opportunities to support? Is there a message that you want our volunteers to know about what we're talking about today?
You know, that's an awesome question. It's always one that when you have these types of challenges, like that's what we need to get better at, including like, as you said before, we need to figure out through university communication networks, same with like Pheasant Forever, when you said these kind of things change our messaging, mm-hmm. I think that's where we're at is, okay, how do we figure out how to message this more? And how do we then make this an easy action item for our networks? So take my answer then with that context, mm-hmm. like
we're
know,
still learning.
We need to learn how to do it better.
Okay.
And that's all of us. And so one is that everybody that's tied to Pheasants Forever, that has a job, you know, in, cause there's a lot of partners here. All of us that have jobs, we need to do a better job of getting this word out through our networks. But then there's this membership, and this is one of the only membership that, you know, you see where there's, people that have no idea of what's happening with all of us that have jobs in grasslands or with pheasants or anything. They have a job, you know, in the middle of a city, and this is a pathway where they get the opportunity to learn and see this. When for everybody that's there, like, this is something every citizen should know. It's the one of the most fundamental things. That's what we did with trees and the rainforests, like how valuable forests are. Mm-hmm. Grasslands are equally as valuable and were taken for granted since this became a country. Mm. That we need every citizen to be literate. Just with that point, yeah. Grasslands have incredible value. I don't care if they know exactly all of it, but that is something that needs to change in our schools, with our kids. That's what I would like to see, is where we're literate on that grasslands are important. And this is one of the only groups, the Pheasant Forever membership, where that demographic obviously comes to your all's events at state, national levels. There's an opportunity there.
Yeah.
At the same time, there's people as well that have, you know, land and hunting opportunities and provide access for, you know, through walk-in or public access programs. And we need to make sure that we're, you know, not losing more pheasant habitat and so forth. And there's partners in every region and place that we continue to do a better job of training them up on how to deal with these mm-hmm. across the, you know, central United States. So reaching out, they should be able to get very good support, especially as we're starting to think of not just for that one person. We tend to then, if one person comes to the table, it's trickling to their neighbors, yeah. and that helps that producer. So I think we need to do a better job of very direct answers than like this academic spinning the wheel, but it is where we need to go next mm-hmm. of public literacy, awareness for our entire hunting community. I mean, we talk about what we like to go hunt, but we don't talk about the ecosystem that those hunting opportunities depend on as much as we should. We're not talking about in our schools. That's why we want to have access on public lands, is to just, that's how we can educate the public in the Great Plains. It's 97% private in Nebraska. Mm. They can't see what these ranchers are doing, but they go to Halsey National Forest and we can communicate why grasslands matter there, or Valentine, or Game and Parks Place. So that's where I want to see us take the next jump. And the membership here can support that. It's like, as you're seeing it, realize why there's a fight on woody encroachment. I mean, we taught so much of how much to love trees. It's hard when you see management on trees. There's a reason. It's because it's the one of the top two threats that impact grassland loss today.
So,
being more vocal, being more connected, leveraging our networks, like it's one of the lines globally that maybe this membership should really know. Grasslands, temperate grasslands, most misunderstood, most underfunded, and least conserved of any of the world's biomes.
Wow.
That's in our backyard. Like, we should change that.
Yeah. That's a powerful statement to end on. I'll add one more thought. And that's, you know, over the last couple of years, we've talked a lot with our membership about the North American Grasslands Conservation Act. And folks think, you know, that's that legislation that, you know, ebbs and flows on whether or not it's going to move in Washington, D.C. And that would create tools to push back on some of the things that we're talking about throughout this entire podcast, is voluntary incentive-based conservation funding to push back woody cover and maintain the integrity of grassland habitat, no matter what state you're in. And that's, again, we just are looking for a variety of tools, particularly to get prescribed fire in the landscape. Durock, thank you very much. I've taken up a ton of your time. I could keep going, but I think we'll end up doing this again, because I continue to be fascinated with your work, and it definitely is influencing the way we message and how we think about what we're doing to push back woody encroachment.
No, thanks. Thanks so much for having me, because these are, we could sit here and do this all day and the poor listeners would have to put up with this, but it's these are the kind of things that are super fun for me, because it's what 8-year-old me got into it for. So no, thank you for the opportunity. And I mean, these are those cool, like, weird career bucket list items. Like, oh, sweet. You know, we get to talk about not the nerdy science stuff. We just get to talk about what's happening and why it matters to us. So this was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it all really does connect. I mean, as hunters, we definitely look through a lens that, you know, that the landscape's changing, and as we evolve and mature, you know, we understand the connections with habitat, and, you know, we see it happening in front of us. So let's make sure a little 8-year-old you, or the next generation, a little 8-year-old you, has places to go.
No doubt. Yeah.
All right. I'm Bob St. Pierre, reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise, folks. Thanks for listening.